You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
It is indeed, yes. So today, well, this week in Worry Week, in fact, we've been discussing the militarization of the Pacific. So I talked to Professor Robert Patman of Otago University about international relations between particularly China and America in the Pacific, and how perhaps militarization is not the form of globalization we'll be seeing most frequently in the Pacific, but how the soft colonization or soft recolonization of infrastructure in the Pacific could perhaps lead to militarization in the future. Here it is. What benefits do any large political powers, in this case perhaps the examples of China, the United States of America, Australia, and India are relevant, stand from gaining from recolonizing the South Pacific region and Indo-Pacific region with military bases?
I think the perception amongst great powers is that they still have the capability to shape the destiny of the world in general, but in the destiny of other countries in particular. Whether that's an accurate perception is another matter. And there's clearly a bit of a battle for influence between the US and China, and possibly Russia to a lesser degree, in the Asia-Pacific. It's one of the most militarized regions of the world. It is the most militarized region of the world. It's countries such as the United States and China, Russia, they have the three biggest budgets, military budgets in the world. The question, however, which you've raised, is that I think both China and the United States are implicitly in a struggle for influence in the region. It's problematic, however, whether this strategy will work. There have been reports recently that China wants to establish a base in Vanuatu, and the speculation that might happen. The perception from the Western side is that China has greatly expanded its activities in the region, in particularly in the Pacific, and has become a key player in development aid. And there's concerns that it may be, in the views of Western analysts, extending loans, which in turn are not really repayable. And there has been concerns that countries like Tonga and Vanuatu, if they incur loans which they cannot really repay, they may become politically compromised in the process.
It's interesting. I was looking at that before, of how essentially they force reliance onto the larger nations. Would you say that things like climate change are almost being used as kind of like a weaponized bargaining chip, in essence, to force smaller Pacific nations' hands into becoming open to militarization schemes from like the aforementioned states?
I think great powers always want to influence, politically influence smaller powers. But we live in, I started off by alluding to the fact it's certainly the perception that great powers think they have it within their control to do this. The question is, objectively, is that true? Because one of the things that really strikes one, if you look in the post-Cold War era, is that great powers have acted unilaterally on occasion, but they've been almost without exception unsuccessful. The United States acted unilaterally, largely with respect to the invasion of Iraq. China has acted unilaterally with respect to South China Sea, where it created some artificial islands and then militarized them. But in the process, they've alarmed their neighbor. And if you want to be a regional or indeed global power, you need good relations with your neighbors. And then look at Russia, acted unilaterally with respect to the Ukraine. About $170 billion in investment left the country in capital flight since about 2014. And the Russian economy didn't record any growth for 3 years after it had roughed up a neighbor. So in short, there's a lot of evidence suggests that great powers' ability to shape the world and indeed shape the destiny of other countries is not as great as they perceive it to be.
Do you think this is why Dr. David Brewster, who's a lecturer at the Australian National University, believes that China is more likely to pursue what is called a places, not bases strategy? Because by placing military bases, as you say, it is alarming to neighbors, whereas possibly developing sports facilities like they have in Papua New Guinea, or roads as they have even at the top of New Zealand, it's not as alarming?
Yes. Although you could argue the objective is the same, which is to politically shape the domestic politics of another country, be it one is a much more benign method, and one is much more provocative. It's difficult to be absolutely accurate. We have seen concerns about China in New Zealand recently as well, and degree of influence. So China is engaging, as we would expect, after 3 decades of sustained economic growth. It would be surprising if China did not seek to bolster its presence on the world stage. But whether it succeeds is another matter. You know, often the great powers look at the rest of the world as sort of pawns on a chessboard. And for reasons I've already gone through, I don't think that's an accurate reading. We live in, even the great powers themselves, the United States and China, are far more interdependent and far more vulnerable than great powers of the past. And we've seen, interestingly, after a flurry of what might be described as a tariff war between the United States and China, both sides of course have agreed to a pause in that process. And that's because trade between China and the United States is not only very substantial, has the ability to hurt both, but it involves what's called global supply chain, with up to 14 to 20 countries involved in those transactions between the two great powers. So I think the world's much more complicated in the 21st century than it was before, and I think the idea that the 21st century is just simply a continuation of the way the world's always been is perhaps deceiving. I think China, coming back to Dr. Brewster's point, is seeking to extend its influence and interconnectivity. Belt and Road Initiative is an illustration of this ambitious global project to increase China's interconnectivity globally. But you could argue that, you know, and I suppose the Chinese government would argue this, led by Xi Jinping, that is in the Chinese national interest. If they can extend their global economic reach, that's got to be good for the Chinese economy.
Certainly. The Bo Declaration, recently signed by the majority of nations within the Pacific or Oceania, reads that security challenges being faced by Pacific nations were broader and more complex than in previous generations.
Yeah.
I assume this is kind of similar to what you were talking about before.
Well, many products that America produces are assembled in numerous countries, which means that ways of doing business previously in the pre-globalization age, where a product was essentially assembled in one country and then exported to another country, that's changed.
Certainly, like with the rise of technology, as you said.
Yeah, and I think that's and I think coming back to a point you made earlier, and I'm sorry I didn't address it immediately, which is the climate change. I think that it's fair to say that a number of military establishments, including some people in the Pentagon, are frustrated that political leaders are not keeping up with the changes which are occurring globally, which mean, for example, climate change, in the words of a Pentagon report back in 2004, it is one of the biggest threats to international and national security around. It's particularly a major threat for national security of Pacific Island states, because the rise in sea level, some of them could cease to be places fit for habitation in the not too distant future, which has major reverberations for both New Zealand and Australia, because populations which are displaced by rising sea levels will probably look to relocate to either one of those countries.
How has US or American policy on what I believe was called East Asian expansion under President Obama changed under President Trump, if it has?
I think just to characterize President Obama's approach, I think it was a mixture of engagement with China in East Asia and the Asia-Pacific region generally, and also competition. The competitive part was underlined with what was called the pivot, which was announced by the Obama administration in October 2011, which was a recognition that China was trying to extend its influence and that the United States would also not be found wanting when it comes to great power competition. So there was this two-track approach with the Obama administration. The Trump administration, I think, has been so far rather reticent on the engagement front. It sees possibilities for cooperation with China, providing China satisfies what the Trump administration believes is preconditions, such as free and fair trade. The Americans believe that China has not been acting in a fair manner when it comes to trade. They believe, they've accused, actually a number of administrations, not just the Trump administration, but the Trump administration has been more vocal about it, manipulation of the Chinese currency, and also there's a sense that China's quite protectionist. I suppose the Trump administration has accentuated the competitive part of the two-track approach rather than the engagement part. Mr. Trump, however, says that recognizes that there is a relationship with economic cooperation. He didn't quite use the word interdependent, but the fact of the matter is that China and the United States do a lot of business together. China does, I mean, I think China, something like 17% or 18% of China's exports go to the United States. So China certainly has a big stake in a relationship with economic cooperation.
Ralph Corser, who is the president of the Pacific Forum, CSIS, said that the jostling for influence in the region was likely to intensify in the future. However, he believes it is highly dependent on the interpretation of Chinese action, possibly even more than Chinese policy, by Washington. Do you think policy or action is more important to observe in upcoming times when discussing international relations in the Pacific?
Well, I think it's very difficult to separate the two. I think there is a consensus in the United States, both in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, that China needs to be contained and at least challenged, and particularly with regard to its trade practices. There may be a difference of emphasis how far that challenge should go. But the interesting thing is that the EU, for example, which is a community of liberal democracies, does not share in the same way the American perception of China. And even locally, to some extent, New Zealand, until recently, has also had a relatively, I wouldn't say benign, but a more relaxed view of China's activities. That is to say that China should be expected that it's seeking to become more diplomatically active. The question, of course, is, and the danger, I think, that Ralph Corso was referring to, is that if you have a mindset or a particular interpretation that China is hell-bent on world domination, your policy towards China may become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because you may then adopt a hostile or defensive policy towards China, which in turn fuels Chinese anxieties, which in turn means it's more forward-leaning than might otherwise be. My sense is that in the recent months, both the Xi Jinping leadership and the Trump administration have begun to take stock and have a pause in their trade war, because they realize, and particularly the United States, I think China's always been quite mindful of this, that such a trade war will harm both. And I think what the point has really come home to the Trump administration, that American companies, some of them are actually relocating outside the United States in order to avoid tariffs on their exports that would be incurred. And so that's very interesting, because, again, it shows you how the traditional understanding of trade has changed. Mr. Trump's idea of putting big tariffs on Chinese and EU products was based on the assumption that most of those products were assembled within the United States, and therefore the United States would, if you like, inverted commas, be able to win a trade war eventually. Whereas, as we outlined earlier, trade has become much more complex, involved long global supply chains, and American companies in a globalized world will relocate outside the United States if necessary to protect their profit margin, which seems to have come as something of a surprise to some members of the Trump administration.
Worry Week on The Wire.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.